This is Audible.
Hopper Audio presents House of Spies by Daniel Silva, performed by George Goodell. Beware the fury of a patient man. John Dryden, Absalom and Achitophel. Part 1. The Loose Thread. Chapter 1. King Saul Boulevard, Tel Aviv. For something so unprecedented, so fraught with institutional risk, it was all handled with a minimum of fuss, and quietly, too. That was the remarkable thing about it, the operational silence with which it was carried out. Yes, there had been the dramatic announcement broadcast live to the nation, and the splashy first cabinet meeting, and the lavish party at Ari Shamron's lakeside villa in Tiberias, where all the friends and collaborators from his remarkable past, the spy masters, the politicians, the Vatican priests, the London art dealers, even an inveterate art thief from Paris, had come to wish him well. But otherwise it came to pass with scarcely a ripple. One day, Uzi Navot was seated behind his large, smoked glass desk in the chief's office, and the next, Gabriel was in his place. Absent Navot's modern desk, mind you, for glass wasn't Gabriel's style. Wood was more to his liking, very old wood, and paintings, of course. He learned quickly he could not spend 12 hours a day in a room without paintings. He hung one or two of his own, unsigned, and several by his mother, who had been one of the most prominent Israeli artists of her day. He even hung a large abstract canvas by his first wife, Leah, which she had painted when they were students together at the Bezalel Academy of Art and Design in Jerusalem. Late in the day, a visitor to the executive floor might hear a bit of opera. La Bohème was a particular favorite, leaking from his door. The music could mean only one thing. Gabriel Alon, the Prince of Fire, the Angel of Vengeance, the chosen son of Ari Shamron, had finally assumed his rightful place as chief of Israel's secret intelligence service. But his predecessor did not go far. In fact, Uzi Navot moved just across the foyer to an office that in the building's original configuration had been Shamron's fortified little lair. Never before had a departing chief remained under the same roof as his successor. It was a violation of one of the most sacred principles of the office, which mandated a clearing away of the brush every few years, a tilling of the soil. True, there were some former chiefs who kept their hand in the game. They wandered into King Saul Boulevard from time to time, swapped war stories, dispensed unheeded advice, and generally made a nuisance of themselves. And then, of course, there was Shamron. The Eternal One, the Burning Bush. Shamron had built the office from the ground up in his own image. He had given the service its identity, its very language, and considered it his divine right to meddle in its affairs as he saw fit. It was Shamron who had awarded Navot the job as chief, and Shamron who, when the time had finally come, had taken it away. But it was Gabriel who insisted Navot remain, with all the perquisites he had enjoyed in his previous incarnation. They shared the same secretary, the formidable Orit, known inside King Saul Boulevard as the Iron Dome for her ability to shoot down unwanted visitors, and Navot retained the use of his official car and a full complement of bodyguards, which provoked a bit of grumbling in the Knesset, but was generally accepted as necessary to keep the peace. His exact title was rather vague, but that was typical of the office. They were liars by trade. They spoke the truth only among themselves. To everyone else, their wives, their children, the citizens they were sworn to protect, they hid behind a cloak of deception. When their respective doors were open, which was usually the case, Gabriel and Navot could see one another across the foyer. They spoke early each morning by secure phone, lunched together, sometimes in the staff dining room, sometimes alone in Gabriel's office, and spent a few minutes of quiet time in the evening, accompanied by Gabriel's opera, which Navot, despite his sophisticated Viennese lineage, detested. Navot had no appreciation for music, and the visual arts bored him. Otherwise, he and Gabriel were in complete agreement on all matters, at least those that involved the office and the security of the State of Israel. Navot had fought for and won access to Gabriel's ear any time he wanted it, and he insisted on being present at all important gatherings of the senior staff. Usually he maintained a sphinx-like silence, with his thick arms folded across his wrestler's chest, and an inscrutable expression on his face. But occasionally he would finish one of Gabriel's sentences for him, as if to make it clear to everyone in the room that, as the Americans were fond of saying, there was no daylight between them. They were like Boaz and Yachin, the twin pillars that stood at the entrance of the first temple of Jerusalem. And anyone who even thought about playing one against the other would pay a heavy price. Gabriel was the people's chief, but he was still the chief, and he would not tolerate intrigue in his court. Not that any was likely, but the other officers who comprised his senior staff were thick as thieves. All were drawn from Barak, the elite team that had carried out some of the most storied operations in the history of a storied service. For years they had worked from a cramped subterranean set of rooms that had once been used as a dumping ground for old furniture and equipment. Now, they occupied a chain of offices stretching from Gabriel's door. Even Eli Lavon, one of Israel's most prominent biblical archaeologists, had agreed to forsake his teaching position at Hebrew University and return to full-time office employment. Nominally, Lavon oversaw the watchers, pickpockets, and those who specialized in planting listening devices and hidden cameras. In truth, Gabriel used him in any way he saw fit. The finest physical surveillance artist the office ever produced, Lavon had been looking over Gabriel's shoulder since the days of Operation Wrath of God. His little hutch, with its shards of pottery and ancient coins and tools, was the place where Gabriel often went for a few minutes of quiet. Lavon had never been much of a talker. Like Gabriel, he did his best work in the dark and without a sound. A few of the old hands questioned whether it was wise for Gabriel to load up the executive suite with so many loyalists and relics from his glorious past. For the most part, however, they kept their concerns to themselves. No director general, other than Shamron, of course, had ever assumed control of the office with more experience or goodwill. Gabriel had been playing the game longer than anyone in the business, and along the way he had collected an extraordinary array of friends and accomplices. The British Prime Minister owed his career to him, the Pope his life. Even so, he was not the sort of fellow to shamelessly collect on an old debt. The truly powerful man, said Shamron, never had to ask for a favor. But he had enemies, too, enemies who had destroyed his first wife, and who had tried to destroy his second as well. Enemies in Moscow and Tehran who viewed him as the only thing standing in the way of their ambitions. For now they had been dealt with, but doubtless they would be back. So, too, would the man with whom he had last done battle. Indeed, it was this man who occupied the top spot on the new director general's to-do list. The office computers had assigned him a randomly generated code name, but behind the cipher-protected doors of Kingshall Boulevard, Gabriel and the new leaders of the office referred to him by the grandiose nom de guerre he had given himself, Saladin. They spoke of him with respect and even a trace of foreboding. He was coming for them. It was only a matter of time. There was a photograph making the rounds of like-minded intelligence services. It had been snapped by an asset of the CIA in the Paraguayan town of Ciudad del Este, which was located in the notorious tri-border area or triple frontier of South America. It showed a man, large, solidly built, Arab in appearance, drinking coffee at an outdoor cafe, accompanied by a certain Lebanese trader suspected of having ties to the global jihadist movement. The camera angle was such that it rendered facial recognition software ineffective. But Gabriel, who was blessed with one of the finest pairs of eyes in the trade, was confident the man was Saladin. He had seen Saladin in person in the lobby of the Four Seasons Hotel in Washington, D.C., 2 days before the worst terrorist attack on the American homeland since 9/11. Gabriel knew how Saladin looked, how he smelled, how the air reacted when he entered or left a room. And he knew how Saladin walked. Like his namesake, he moved with a pronounced limp, the result of a shrapnel wound that had been crudely tended to in a house of many rooms and courts near Mosul in northern Iraq. The limp was now his calling card. A man's physical appearance could be changed in many ways. Hair could be cut or dyed, a face could be altered with plastic surgery, but a limp, like Saladin's, was forever. How he managed to escape from America was a matter of intense debate. and all subsequent efforts to locate him had failed. Reports had him variously in Asunción, Santiago, and Buenos Aires. There was even a rumor he'd found sanctuary in Bariloche, the Argentine ski resort so beloved by fugitive Nazi war criminals. Gabriel dismissed the idea out of hand. Still, he was willing to entertain the notion that Saladin was hiding somewhere in plain sight. Wherever he was planning his next move. Of that, Gabriel was certain. The recent attack on Washington, with its ruined buildings and monuments and catastrophic death toll, had established Saladin as the new face of Islamic terror. But what would be his encore? The American president, in one of his final interviews before leaving office, declared that Saladin was incapable of another large-scale operation, that the U.S. military response had left his once formidable network in tatters. Saladin had responded by ordering a suicide bomber to detonate himself outside the U.S. Embassy in Cairo. "Small beer," countered the White House. "Limited casualties, no Americans among the dead. The desperate act of a man on his way out." Perhaps. But there were other attacks as well. Saladin had struck Turkey virtually at will. Weddings, buses, public squares, Istanbul's busy airport, and his adherents in Western Europe, those who spoke his name with something like religious fervor, had carried out a series of lone wolf attacks that had left a trail of death across France, Belgium, and Germany. But something big was coming. Something coordinated. A terror spectacular to rival the calamity he had inflicted on Washington. But where? Another attack on America seemed unlikely. Surely, said the experts, lightning would not strike the same place twice. In the end, the city Saladin chose for his curtain call came as a surprise to no one, especially those who battled terrorists for a living. Despite his penchant for secrecy, Saladin loved the stage. And where better to find a stage than the West End of London? Chapter 2. St. James's, London. Perhaps it was true, thought Julian Isherwood, as he watched torrents of wind-blown rain tumbling from a black sky. Perhaps the planet was broken after all. A hurricane in London, and in the middle of February at that. Tall and somewhat precarious in comportment, Isherwood was not naturally built for such conditions. At present he was sheltering in the doorway of Wilton's restaurant in Jermyn Street, a spot he knew well. He pushed up the sleeve of his Macintosh and frowned at his wristwatch. The time was 7:40. He was running late. He searched the street for a taxi. There was not one in sight. From the bar at Wilton's there came a trickle of half-hearted laughter, followed by the booming baritone voice of none other than tubby Oliver Dimbleby. Wilton's was now the primary watering hole for a small band of old master art dealers who plied their trade in the narrow streets of St. James's. Green's restaurant and oyster bar in Duke Street had once been their favorite haunt, but Green's had been forced to close its doors owing to a dispute with the company that managed the Queen's immense portfolio of London real estate. It was symptomatic of the changes that had swept through the neighborhood and the London art world as a whole. Old masters were deeply out of fashion. The collectors of today, the instant global billionaires who made their fortunes with social media and iPhone apps, were only interested in modern works. Even the Impressionists were becoming passé. Isherwood had sold just two paintings since the New Year. Both were middle-market works, school of so-and-so, manner of such-and-such. Oliver Dimbleby hadn't sold anything in 6 months. Neither had Roddy Hutchinson, who was widely regarded as the most unscrupulous dealer in all of London. But each evening they huddled at the bar of Wilton's and assured themselves that soon the storm would pass. Julian Isherwood feared otherwise, never more so than at that moment. He had seen troubled times before. His English scale, devoutly English wardrobe and backbone of England surname, concealed the fact that he was not, at least not technically, English at all. British by nationality and passport, yes, but German by birth, French by upbringing, and Jewish by religion. Only a handful of trusted friends knew that Isherwood had staggered into London as a child refugee in 1942 after being carried across the snowbound Pyrenees by a pair of Basque shepherds, or that his father, the renowned Paris art dealer Samuel Isakowitz, had been murdered at the Sobibor death camp along with Isherwood's mother. Though Isherwood had carefully guarded the secrets of his past, the story of his dramatic escape from Nazi-occupied Europe had reached the ears of Israel's secret intelligence service. And in the mid-1970s, during a wave of Palestinian terrorist attacks against Israeli targets in Europe, he had been recruited as a sayan, a volunteer helper. Isherwood had but one assignment, to assist in building and maintaining the operational cover of an art restorer and assassin named Gabriel Allon. Lately, their careers had proceeded in decidedly different directions. Gabriel was now the chief of Israeli intelligence, one of the most powerful spies in the world. And Isherwood? He was standing in the doorway of Wilton's restaurant in German Street, battered by the west wind, slightly drunk, waiting for a taxi that would never come. He checked his watch a second time. It was now 7:43. Having no umbrella in his possession, he raised his old leather satchel over his head and waded over to Piccadilly, where, after a wait of 5 sodden minutes, he tipped gratefully into the back of a taxi. He gave the driver an approximate address. He was too embarrassed to say the name of his true destination, and anxiously monitored the time as the taxi crawled toward Piccadilly Circus. There it turned into Shaftesbury Avenue, arriving at Charing Cross Road at the stroke of 8. Isherwood was now officially late for his reservation. He supposed he ought to call and say he was delayed, but there was a good chance the establishment in question would give away his table. It had taken a month of begging and bribery to obtain it in the first place. Isherwood wasn't about to risk it now with a panicked phone call. Besides, with a bit of luck, Fiona was already there. It was one of the things Isherwood liked best about Fiona. She was prompt. He also liked her blonde hair, blue eyes, long legs, and her age, which was 36. In fact, at that moment, he could think of nothing he disliked about Fiona Gardner, which was why he had expended much valuable time and effort securing a reservation in a restaurant where, ordinarily, he would never set foot. Another 5 minutes slipped away before the taxi finally deposited Isherwood outside St. Martin's Theatre, the permanent home of Agatha Christie's The Mousetrap. Quickly he crossed West Street to the entrance of the famed Ivy, his true destination. The maitre d' informed him that Miss Gardner had not yet arrived, and that by some miracle his table was still available. Isherwood surrendered his Macintosh to the coat check girl and was shown to a banquette overlooking Litchfield Street. Alone, he stared disapprovingly at his reflection in the window. With his Savile Row suit, crimson necktie, and plentiful grey locks, he cut a rather elegant, if dubious, figure, a look he described as dignified depravity. Still, there was no denying he had reached the age that estate planners referred to as the autumn of his years. No, he thought gloomily, he was old. Far too old to be pursuing the likes of Fiona Gardner. How many others had there been? The art students? The junior curators? The receptionists? The pretty young girls who took telephone bids at Christie's and Sotheby's? Isherwood was no sportsman. He had loved them all. He believed in love, as he believed in art. Love at first sight. Love everlasting. Love until death do us part. The problem was, he had never truly found it. All at once he thought of a recent afternoon in Venice. A corner table in Harry's bar, a Bellini, Gabriel. He had told Isherwood it was not too late, that there was still time for him to marry and have a child or two. The ragged face in the glass begged to differ. He was well past his expiration date, he thought. He would die alone, childless, and with no wife other than his gallery. He made another check of the time, 8:15. Now it was Fiona who was late. It wasn't like her. He dug his mobile from the breast pocket of his suit and saw that he had received a text message. Sorry, Julian, but I'm afraid I won't be able to. He supposed it was for the best. It would spare him a broken heart. More important, it would prevent him from making a damn fool of himself yet again. He returned the mobile to his pocket and considered his options. He could stay and dine alone, or he could leave. He chose the second. One didn't dine alone at the Ivy. Rising, he collected his raincoat, and with a mumbled apology to the maitre d' went quickly into the street, just as a white Ford Transit van was breaking to a halt outside St. Martin's Theatre. The driver emerged instantly, dressed in a bulky woolen peacoat and holding something that looked like a gun. It was not any gun, thought Isherwood. It was a weapon of war. Four more men were now clambering out of the van's rear cargo compartment, each wearing a heavy coat, each holding the same type of combat assault rifle. Isherwood would scarcely believe what he was seeing. It looked like a scene from a movie he had seen before in Paris and in Washington. The five men moved calmly toward the doors of the theater in a tight-fitting unit. Isherwood heard the splintering of wood, followed by gunshots. Then a few seconds later came the first screams, muffled, distant. They were the screams of Isherwood's nightmares. Again he thought of Gabriel and wondered what he would do in a situation like this. He would charge headlong into the theater and save as many lives as possible. But Isherwood hadn't Gabriel's skills or his courage. He was no hero. In fact, he was quite the other thing. The nightmarish screams were growing louder. Isherwood dug his mobile phone from his pocket, dialed 999, and reported that St. Martin's Theatre was under terrorist attack. Then he spun round and stared at the landmark restaurant he had just departed. Its well-heeled customers appeared oblivious to the carnage taking place a few paces away. Surely, he thought, the terrorists would not be content with a single massacre. The iconic Ivy would be their next stop. Isherwood considered his options. Again, he had two. He could make his escape, or he could try to save as many lives as possible. The decision was the easiest of his life. As he staggered across the street, he heard an explosion from the direction of Charing Cross Road, then another, then a third. He was not a hero, he thought, as he careened through the door of the Ivy, waving his arms like a madman, but he could act like one, if only for a moment or two. Perhaps Gabriel had been right. Perhaps it was not too late for him, after all. Chapter 3 Vauxhall Cross, London. They were 12 in number. Arabs and Africans by ethnicity, Europeans by passport. All had spent time in the Caliphate of ISIS, including a training camp now destroyed near the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra, and all had returned to Western Europe undetected. Later, it would be established they had received their orders via telegram, the free cloud-based instant messaging service utilizing end-to-end encryption. They were given only an address and the date and time they were to appear. They did not know that others had received similar instructions. They did not know they were part of a larger plot. Indeed, they did not know they were part of a plot at all. They trickled into the United Kingdom one by one, by train and by ferry. Two or three had to undergo a bit of questioning at the border. The rest were welcomed with open arms. Four made their way to the town of Luton, four to Harlow, and four to Gravesend. At each address, a British-based operative of the network was waiting. So, too, were their weapons. Explosive vests, combat assault rifles. The vests each contained a kilogram of TATP, a highly volatile crystalline explosive manufactured from nail polish remover and hydrogen peroxide. The assault rifles were AK-47s of Belarusian manufacture. The British-based operatives quickly briefed the attack cells on their targets and the objectives of the mission. They were not suicide bombers, but suicide warriors. They were to kill as many infidels as possible with their assault rifles, and only when cornered by police were they to detonate their explosive vests. The goal of the operation was not the destruction of buildings or landmarks, it was blood. No distinction was to be made between man or woman, adult or child. They were to show no mercy. In late afternoon, in Luton, in Harlow, and in Gravesend, the members of the three cells shared a final meal. Afterward, they ritually prepared their bodies for death. Finally, at 7 that evening, they climbed into three identical white Ford Transit vans. The British-based operatives handled the driving. The suicide warriors sat in back with their vests and their guns. None of the cells knew of the existence of the others, but all were headed toward the west end of London and were scheduled to strike at the same time. The clock was Saladin's trademark. He believed that in terror, as in life, timing was everything. The venerable Garrick Theatre had seen world wars, a Cold War, a Depression, and the abdication of a king. But never had it witnessed anything like what occurred at 8:20 that evening, when five ISIS terrorists burst into the theatre and began firing into the crowd. More than 100 would perish during the first 30 seconds of the assault, and another 100 would die in the terrible 5 minutes that followed, as the terrorists moved methodically through the theatre, row by row, seat by seat. Some 200 fortunate souls managed to escape through the side and rear exits, along with the entire cast of the production and the stagehands. Many would never work in the theatre again. The terrorists emerged from the Garrick 7 minutes after entering it. Outside, they encountered two unarmed Metropolitan police officers. After killing both, they headed to Irving Street and slaughtered their way from restaurant to restaurant until finally, at the fringes of Leicester Square, they were confronted by a pair of Met Special Firearms officers. The officers were armed only with 9mm Glock 17 pistols. Even so, they managed to kill two of the terrorists before they were able to detonate their explosive vests. Two of the surviving terrorists set off their bombs in the lobby of the cavernous Odeon Cinema, the third in a busy Italian restaurant. In all, nearly 400 would perish in that portion of the attack alone, making it the deadliest in British history. Worse even than the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. But unfortunately, the five-member cell was not acting alone. A second cell, the Luton cell as it would become known, attacked the Prince Edward Theatre, also at 8:20 precisely, during a performance of Miss Saigon. The Prince Edward was far larger than the Garrick, 1,600 seats instead of 656, and so the death toll inside the theatre was considerably higher. What's more, all five of the terrorists detonated their suicide vests in bars and restaurants along Old Compton Street. More than 500 lives were lost in the span of just 6 minutes. The third target was St. Martin's. Five terrorists, 8:20 precisely. This time, however, a team of special firearms officers intervened. Later, it would be revealed that a passerby, a man identified only as a prominent London art dealer, had reported the attack to authorities seconds after the terrorists entered the theatre. The same London art dealer had then helped to evacuate the dining room of the Ivy restaurant. As a result, only 84 would die in that portion of the attack. On any other night, in any other city, the number would have been unthinkable. Now it was a reason to give thanks. Saladin had struck terror into the heart of London, and London would never be the same. By morning, the scale of the calamity was plain to see. Most of the dead still lay where they had fallen, indeed many still sat in their original theatre seats. The commissioner of the Metropolitan Police declared the entire West End an active crime scene and urged both Londoners and tourists to avoid the area. The Underground cancelled all service as a precautionary measure. Businesses and public institutions remained closed throughout the day. The London Stock Exchange opened on time, but trading was suspended when share prices plummeted. The economic loss, like the loss of life, was catastrophic. For reasons of security, Prime Minister Jonathan Lancaster waited until midday to tour the devastation. With his wife Diana at his side, he made his way on foot from the Garrick to the Prince Edward and finally to the St. Martin's. Afterward, outside the Met's makeshift command post in Leicester Square, he briefly addressed the media. Pale and visibly shaken, he vowed the perpetrators would be brought to justice. "The enemy is determined," he declared, "but so are we." The enemy, however, remained curiously quiet. Yes, there were several celebratory postings on the usual extremist websites, but nothing of authority from ISIS Central Command. Finally, at 5 p.m. London time, a formal claim of responsibility appeared on one of the group's many Twitter feeds, along with photographs of the 15 operatives who had carried out the attack. A few terrorism analysts expressed surprise over the fact that the statement made no mention of anyone named Saladin. The savvier ones did not. Saladin, they said, was a master, and like many masters, he preferred to leave his work unsigned. If the first day was characterized by solidarity and grief, the second was one of division and recriminations. In the House of Commons, several members of the opposition party lambasted the Prime Minister and his intelligence chiefs for failing to detect and disrupt the plot. Mainly, they asked how it was possible that the terrorists had managed to acquire combat assault rifles in a country with some of the most draconian gun control laws in the world. The head of the Met's counterterrorism command issued a statement defending his actions, as did Amanda Wallace, the director general of MI5. But Graham Seymour, the chief of the Secret Intelligence Service, otherwise known as MI6, chose to remain silent. Until recently, the British government had not even acknowledged the existence of MI6, and no minister in his right mind would have ever dreamed of mentioning the name of its chief in public. Seymour preferred the old ways to the new. He was a spy by nature and upbringing. And a spy never spoke for attribution when a poisonous leak to a friendly reporter would suffice. Responsibility for protecting the British homeland from terrorist attack fell primarily to MI5, the Metropolitan Police, and the Joint Terrorism Analysis Center. Still, the Secret Intelligence Service had an important role to play in detecting plots abroad before they reached Britain's vulnerable shores. Graham Seymour had warned the Prime Minister repeatedly that an ISIS attack on the United Kingdom was imminent, but his spies had failed to produce the hard, actionable intelligence necessary to prevent it. Consequently, he regarded the attack on London, with its horrendous loss of innocent life, as the greatest single failure of his long and distinguished career. Seymour had been in his magnificent office atop Vauxhall Cross at the time of the attack. He had seen the flashes of the explosions from his window, and in the dark days that followed, he rarely left it. His closest aides pleaded with him to get some sleep, and privately fretted over his uncharacteristically worn appearance. Seymour curtly advised them their time would be better spent finding the vital intelligence that would prevent the next attack. What he wanted was a loose thread, a member of Saladin's network who could be manipulated into doing his bidding. Not a senior figure, they were far too loyal. The man Graham Seymour was looking for would be a small player, a runner of errands, a carrier of other people's bags. It was possible this man might not even know he was a member of a terror organization. It was even possible he had never heard the name Saladin. Policemen, secret or otherwise, have certain advantages in times of crisis. They stage raids, they make arrests, they hold press conferences to reassure the public they are doing everything in their power to keep them safe. Spies, on the other hand, have no such recourse. By definition, they toil in secret, in back alleys and hotel rooms and safe houses and all the other godforsaken places where agents are persuaded or coerced into handing over vital information to a foreign power. Early in his career, Graham Seymour had carried out such work. Now he could only monitor the efforts of others from the gilded cage of his office. His worst fear was that another service would find the loose thread first, that he would once again be relegated to a supporting role. MI6 could not crack Saladin's network alone. It would need the help of its friends in Western Europe, the Middle East, and across the pond in America. But if MI6 were able to unearth the right piece of intelligence in a timely fashion, Graham Seymour would be first among equals. In the modern world, that was the best a spymaster could hope for. And so he remained in his office, day after day, night after night, and watched with no small amount of envy as the Met and MI5 rolled up remnants of Saladin's network in Britain. MI6's efforts, however, produced nothing of consequence. Indeed, Seymour learned more from his friends in Langley and Tel Aviv than he did from his own staff. Finally, a week to the day after the attack, he decided a night at home would do him good. The computer logs would show his Jaguar limousine departed the parking garage, coincidentally, at 8:20 p.m., precisely. But as he was heading across the Thames toward his home in Belgravia, his secure phone purred softly. He recognized the number, along with the female voice that came on the line a moment later. "I hope I'm not catching you at a bad time," said Amanda Wallace. but I have something that might be of interest. Why don't you stop by my place for a drink? My treat. Chapter 4. Thames House, London. Thames House, MI5's riverfront headquarters, was a building Graham Seymour knew well. He had worked there for more than 30 years before becoming the chief of MI6. As he made his way along the corridor of the executive suite, he paused in the doorway of the office that had been his when he was deputy director general. Miles Kent, the current deputy, was still at his desk. He was quite possibly the only man in London who looked worse than Seymour. "Graham," said Kent, looking up from his computer, "what brings you to our little corner of the realm?"
"You tell me."
"If I did," said Kent quietly, "the Queen Bee would give me the sack." "How's she holding up?" "Haven't you heard?" Kent beckoned Seymour inside and closed the door. "Charles ran off with his secretary."
"When?"
"A couple of days after the attack. He was having dinner at the Ivy when the third cell entered the St. Martin's. Said it forced him to take a hard look in the mirror, said he couldn't go on living the way he was.
He had a mistress and a wife. What more did he want?"
"A divorce, apparently. Amanda's already moved out of the flat. She's been sleeping here at the office."
"There's a lot of that going around."
Seymour was surprised by the news. He had seen Amanda that very morning at 10 Downing Street, and she'd made no mention of it. Truth be told, Seymour was relieved Charles's reckless love life was finally out in the open. The Russians had a way of finding out about such indiscretions and had never been squeamish about using them to their advantage.
"Who else knows?"
"I found out quite by accident. You know Amanda, she's very discreet."
"Too bad Charles wasn't."
Seymour reached for the door but stopped.
"Any idea why she wants to see me so urgently?"
"The pleasure of your company."
"Come on, Miles."
"All I know," said Kent, "is that it has something to do with guns." Seymour went into the corridor. The light over Amanda's door shone green. Even so, he knocked softly before entering. He found Amanda seated at her large desk, with her eyes cast downward toward an open file. Looking up, she treated Seymour to a cool smile. It looked, he thought, as if she had taught herself the gesture by practicing in front of a mirror. "Graham," she said, rising, "so good of you to come." She stepped slowly from behind the desk. She was dressed, as usual, in a tailored pantsuit that flattered her tall, awkward frame. Her approach was cautious. Graham Seymour and Amanda Wallace had entered MI5 in the same intake and had spent the better part of 30 years battling each other at every turn. Now they occupied two of the most powerful positions in Western intelligence, and yet their rivalry persisted. It was tempting to think the attack would alter the dynamics of their relationship, but Seymour believed otherwise. The inevitable parliamentary inquiry was coming. Undoubtedly, it would uncover serious lapses and missteps on the part of MI5. Amanda would fight tooth and nail, and she would do her utmost to make certain that Seymour and MI6 shouldered their fair share of the blame. A drinks tray had been placed at the end of Amanda's gleaming conference table. She mixed a gin and tonic for Seymour and for herself, a martini with olives and cocktail onions. Her toast was restrained, silent. Then she led Seymour to the seating area and gestured toward a modern leather armchair. The BBC flickered in the large, flat-panel television. British and American warplanes were striking ISIS targets near the Syrian city of Raqqa. The Iraqi portion of the caliphate had been largely reclaimed by the central government in Baghdad. Only the Syrian sanctuary remained, and it was under siege. The loss of territory, however, had done nothing to diminish ISIS's ability to conduct terrorist operations abroad. The attack on London was proof of that.
"Where do you suppose he is?"
asked Amanda after a moment.
"Saladin."
"Who else?"
"We've been unable to definitively—"
"You're not speaking to the Prime Minister, Graham."
"If I had to guess, he's somewhere other than the rapidly shrinking caliphate of ISIS."
"Where?"
"Perhaps Libya? Or one of the Gulf Emirates? Or he could be in Pakistan or across the border in Afghanistan, controlled by ISIS. Or," said Seymour, "he might be closer at hand. He has friends and resources. And remember, he used to be one of us. Saladin worked for the Iraqi Mukhabarat before the invasion. His job was to provide material support to Saddam's favorite Palestinian terrorists. He knows what he's doing.
That, said Amanda Wallace, is an understatement.
Saladin almost makes one nostalgic for the days of KGB spies and IRA bombs. She sat down opposite Seymour and placed her drink thoughtfully on the coffee table.
There's something I need to tell you, Graham. Something personal, something awful. Charles has left me for his secretary. She's half his age. Such a cliché.
I'm sorry, Amanda.
Did you know he was having an affair?
One heard rumors, said Seymour delicately.
I didn't hear them, and I'm the director general of MI5. I suppose it's true what they say. The spouse is always the last to know.
Is there no chance of reconciliation?
None.
A divorce will be messy.
And costly, added Amanda, especially for Charles.
There'll be pressure for you to step aside.
Which is why, said Amanda, I'm going to require your support. She was silent for a moment. I know I'm largely to blame for our little Cold War, Graham, but it's gone on long enough. If the Berlin Wall can come down, surely you and I can be something like friends.
I couldn't agree more. This time, Amanda's smile almost appeared genuine.
And now to the real reason I asked you to come.
She pointed a remote toward the flat panel television, and a face appeared on the screen. A male of Egyptian descent, lightly bearded, approximately 30 years of age. It belonged to Omar Salah, the leader of the so-called Harlow cell, who had been killed by a special firearms officer inside St. Martin's Theater before he could detonate his explosive vest. Seymour was well acquainted with Salah's file. He was one of several thousand European Muslims who had traveled to Syria and Iraq after ISIS declared its caliphate in June 2014. For more than a year after Omar Salah's return to Britain, he had been the target of full-time MI5 surveillance, both physical and electronic. But 6 months prior to the attack, MI5 concluded that Salah was no longer an imminent threat. A4, the watchers, were stretched to the breaking point, and Salah appeared to have lost his taste for radical Islam and jihadism. The termination order bore Amanda's signature. What she and the rest of British intelligence didn't realize was that Salah was communicating with ISIS Central Command using encrypted methods that even the mighty American National Security Agency couldn't crack. It wasn't your fault, said Seymour quietly.
Perhaps not, answered Amanda. But someone will have to take the fall. And it's probably going to be me. Unless, of course, I can turn the unfortunate case of Omar Salah to my advantage. She paused, then added, or should I say, our advantage.
And how might we do that?
Omar Salah did more than lead a team of Islamic murderers into St. Martin's Theater. He was the one who smuggled the guns into Britain.
Where did he get them?
From an ISIS operative based in France.
Says who?
Says Omar.
Please, Amanda, said Seymour wearily. It's late.
She glanced at the face on the screen. He was good, our Omar, but he made one small mistake. He used his sister's laptop to conduct ISIS business. We seized it the day after the attack, and we've been scrubbing the hard drive ever since. This afternoon we found the digital remains of an encrypted message from ISIS Central Command instructing Omar to travel to Calais to meet with a man who called himself the Scorpion.
Catchy,
said Seymour darkly.
Was there any mention of guns in the message?
The language was coded but obvious. It's also consistent with a bulletin we received from the DGSI late last year. It seems the French have had the Scorpion on their radar for some time. Unfortunately, they don't know much about him, including his real name. The working theory is that he's part of a drug gang, probably Moroccan.
It made sense, thought Seymour.
The nexus between ISIS and European criminal networks was undeniable.
Have you told the French about any of this?
He asked. I won't leave the security of the British people in the hands of the DGSI. Besides, I'd like to find the Scorpion before the French. But I can't, she added quickly. My mandate stops at the water's edge.
Seymour was silent.
Far be it from me to tell you how to do your job, Graham. But if I were you, I'd send an officer to France first thing in the morning. Someone who speaks the language, someone who knows his way around criminal networks. Someone who isn't afraid to get his hands dirty, she smiled. You wouldn't happen to know anyone like that, would you, Graham?
Chapter 5. Hampshire, England. He had come to the port city in the south of England, like many others before him, in the back of a government van with blacked-out windows. It had sped past the marinas and the old red-brick Victorian warehouses before finally turning onto a small track that carried it across the first fairway of a golf course, which, on the morning of his arrival, had been abandoned to the gulls. Just beyond the fairway was an empty moat, and beyond the moat was an ancient fort with walls of grey stone. Originally built by Henry VIII in 1545, it was now MI6's primary school for spies. The van paused briefly at the gatehouse before entering the central courtyard, where the cars of the DS, the directing staff, stood in three neat rows. The driver of the van, who was called Reg, switched off the engine and, with little more than a dip of his head, signaled to the man in the back seat that he could see himself out. The fort was not a hotel, he might have added, but didn't. The new recruit was a special case, or so the DS had been informed by Vauxhall Cross. Like all new recruits, he would be told at every opportunity that he was being admitted into an exclusive club. The members of this club lived by a different set of rules than their countrymen. They knew things, did things that others did not. That said, the man in the back seat didn't strike Reg as the sort of fellow who would be moved by such flattery. In fact, he looked as though he'd been living by a different set of rules for a very long time. The fort consisted of three wings, the east, the west, and the main, where most of the actual training took place. Directly above the gatehouse was a suite of rooms reserved for the chief, and beyond the walls was a tennis court, a squash facility, a croquet pitch, a helipad, and an outdoor shooting range. There was an indoor range as well, though Reg suspected his passenger would not require much in the way of weapons training, firearms or otherwise. He was a soldier of the elite variety. You could see it in the shape of the body, the set of the jaw, and in the way he shouldered the canvas duffel bag before striking out across the courtyard. Without a sound, noted Reg, he was definitely the silent type. He had been places he wished to forget, and had carried out missions no one talked about outside safe speech rooms and secure facilities. He was classified, this one. He was trouble. Just inside the entrance to the west wing was the little nook where George Halliday, the porter, waited to receive him. Milo, said the new recruit with little conviction. And then, almost as an afterthought, he added, Peter Milo. And Halliday, who was the longest-serving of the directing staff, a holdover from the days of King Henry, according to fort legend, ran a pale, spidery forefinger down his list of names.
Ah, yes, Mr. Marlowe. We've been expecting you. Sorry about the weather, but I'd get used to it if I were you.
Halliday said this while stooping to remove a key from the row of hooks beneath his desk.
Second floor, last room on the left. You're lucky. It has a lovely view of the sea.
He laid the key on the desktop.
I trust you can manage your bag.
I trust I can, said the new recruit, with something like a smile.
Oh, said Halliday suddenly, I nearly forgot.
He turned and clawed a small envelope from one of the pigeonhole mailboxes on the wall behind his desk.
This arrived for you last night. It's from C.
The new recruit scooped up the letter and shoved it into the pocket of his watchcoat. Then he shouldered his canvas duffel, like a soldier, agreed Halliday, and cantered up the flight of ancient steps that led to the residential quarters. The door to the room opened with a groan. Entering, he allowed the duffel to slide from his sturdy shoulder to the floor. With the keen eye of a close observation specialist, he surveyed his surroundings. A single bed, a nightstand and reading lamp, a small desk, a simple armoire for his things, a private toilet and bath. A recent graduate of an elite university might have found the apartment more than adequate, but the new recruit was not impressed. A man of considerable wealth, illegitimate but considerable nonetheless, he was used to more comfortable lodgings. He shed his coat and tossed it on the bed, dislodging the envelope from the pocket. Reluctantly, he tore open the flap and removed the small note card. There was no letterhead, only three lines of neat script, rendered in distinctive green ink. "Britain is better off now that you are here to look after her." An ordinary recruit might have retained possession of such a note as a memento of his first day as an officer in one of the world's oldest and proudest intelligence services. But the man known as Peter Marlowe was no ordinary recruit. What's more, he had worked in places where such a note could cost a man his life. And so, after reading it, twice, as was his custom, he burned it in the bathroom sink and washed the ashes down the drain. Then he went to the room's small arrow slit of a window and gazed across the sea toward the Isle of Wight. And he wondered, not for the first time, whether he had made the worst mistake of his life. His real name, needless to say, was not Peter Marlowe. It was Christopher Keller, which was intriguing in its own right, for, as far as Her Majesty's government was concerned, Keller had been dead for some 25 years. Consequently, he was thought to be the first decedent to serve in any department of British intelligence since Glyndŵr Michael, the homeless Welshman whose corpse had been used by the great wartime deceivers to feed false documents to Nazi Germany as part of Operation Mincemeat. The directing staff of the fort, however, did not know any of this about their new recruit. In fact, they knew almost nothing at all. They did not know, for example, that he was a veteran of the elite Special Air Service, that he still held the record for the regiment's 40-mile endurance trek across the rugged Brecon Beacons of South Wales, or that he had achieved the highest score ever in the Killing House, the SAS's infamous training facility where members honed their close-quarters combat skills. A further examination of his records, all of which had been sealed by order of the Prime Minister himself, would have revealed that in the late 1980s, during a particularly violent period of the war in Northern Ireland, he'd been inserted into West Belfast, where he lived among the city's Roman Catholics and ran agents of penetration into the Irish Republican Army. Those same records would have mentioned, in rather vague terms, an incident at a farmhouse in South Armagh where Keller, his cover blown, had been taken for interrogation and execution. The exact circumstances surrounding his escape were murky, though it involved the death of four hardened IRA men, two of whom had been virtually cut to pieces. After his hasty evacuation from Northern Ireland, Keller returned to SAS headquarters at Hereford for what he thought would be a long rest and a stint as an instructor. But after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in August 1990, he was assigned to a Sabre desert warfare squadron and dispatched to western Iraq, where he searched for Saddam Hussein's lethal arsenal of Scud missiles. On the night of January 28, 1991, Keller and his team located a launcher about 100 miles northwest of Baghdad and radioed the coordinates to their commanders in Saudi Arabia. 90 minutes later, a formation of coalition fighter bombers streaked low over the desert. But in a disastrous case of friendly fire, the aircraft attacked the SAS squadron instead of the Scud site. British officials concluded the entire unit was lost, including Keller. In truth, he had survived the incident without a scratch, which was his neck. His first instinct was to radio his base and request extraction. Instead, enraged by the incompetence of his superiors, he started walking. Concealed beneath the robe and headdress of a desert Arab and highly trained in the art of clandestine movement, he made his way through the coalition forces and slipped undetected into Syria. From there, he hiked westward across Turkey, Greece, and Italy until finally he washed ashore on the rugged island of Corsica, where he fell into the waiting arms of Don Anton Orsatti, a crime figure whose ancient family of Corsican bandits specialized in murder for hire. The Don gave Keller a villa and a woman to heal his wounds. Then, when Keller was rested, he gave him work. With his Northern European looks and SAS training, Keller was able to fulfill contracts that were beyond the capabilities of Orsatti's Corsican-born assassins, the Taranaggio. Posing as an executive for Orsatti's small olive oil company, Keller roamed Western Europe for the better part of 25 years, killing at the Don's behest. They accepted him as one of their own, the Corsicans, and he repaid their generosity by adopting their ways. He dressed as a Corsican, ate and drank as a Corsican, and viewed the rest of the world with a Corsican's fatalistic disdain. He even wore a Corsican talisman around his neck, a lump of red coral in the shape of a hand, to ward off the evil eye. Now, at long last, he had come home, to an ancient fortress of gray stone, overlooking a cold granite sea. They were going to teach him to be a proper British spy. But first, he would have to learn how to be an Englishman again. The other members of Keller's intake were more in keeping with MI6's traditional tastes, white, male, and members of the middle or privileged classes. Moreover, all were recent graduates of either Oxford or Cambridge, all but Thomas Finch, who had attended the London School of Economics and worked as an investment banker in the city before finally submitting to MI6's repeated advances. Finch spoke Chinese fluently and thought himself especially clever. During their first session, he had complained, only partially in jest, that he was taking a substantial cut in pay for the honor of serving his country. Keller could have made the same boast, but had the good sense not to. He told his fellow recruits he had worked in the retail food business and that in his spare time he enjoyed mountaineering, both of which happened to be true. As for his age, he was by far the oldest of the lot, perhaps the oldest recruit ever. He claimed to be something of a late bloomer, which was not at all the case. The course was known formally as the IONEC, the Intelligence Officer's New Entry Course. Its purpose was to prepare a recruit for an entry-level job at Vauxhall Cross, though additional training would be necessary before he would be ready to operate in the field, lest he do irreparable harm to his country's interests or his own career. There were two primary instructors, Andy Mayhew, big, ginger, garrulous, and Tony Quill, a whippet thin former agent runner who, it was said, could charm the habit off a nun and steal her rosary when she wasn't looking. Vauxhall Cross had scoured the records of both men to determine whether in their previous lives they might have encountered an SAS operative named Christopher Keller. They had not. Mayhew was largely a headquarters man. Quill was Iron Curtain and Middle East. Neither had ever set foot in Northern Ireland. The first portion of the course dealt with MI6 itself, its history, its successes, its stunning failures, its structure. It was far smaller than its American and Russian counterparts, but punched above its weight, as Quill was fond of saying, thanks to the native cunning and natural deceptiveness of those who ran it. Whereas the Americans depended on technology, MI6 specialized in human intelligence, and its officers were regarded as the finest recruiters and runners of agents in the business. The hard work of convincing men and women to betray their countries or organizations was carried out by the IB, the intelligence branch. Approximately 350 officers were assigned to it. Most worked in British embassies around the world under the safety of diplomatic cover. Another 800 or so worked in the General Services Division. GS officers specialized in technical matters or held administrative positions in MI6's various geographic controllerates. Each controllerate was headed by a controller who reported to the chief. Though Mayhew and Quill did not know it, C had already determined that the recruit known as Peter Marlowe would not be working in any of the existing controllerates. He would be a controllerate unto himself, a controllerate of one. Having poured the institutional concrete, Mayhew and Quill turned their attention to the tradecraft of human intelligence, the maintenance of proper cover, detecting and shaking surveillance, secret writing, dead drops, brush contacts, memory drills. For a spy's memory, said Quill, was his only friend in the world. And then, of course, there were the long and detailed lectures on how to spot and then successfully recruit human sources of intelligence. Keller had an unfair advantage over his classmates. He had recruited and run agents in a place where one small misstep would result in an atrocious diff. In fact, he was quite certain he could have taught Mayhew and Quill a thing or two about conducting a clandestine meeting in such a way that both agent and officer survived the encounter. Instead, in the classrooms of the main wing, he adopted the demeanor of a quiet and attentive pupil, eager to learn but not to ingratiate or impress. He left that to Finch and to Baker, a literature student from Oxford who was already making notes for his first spy novel. Keller spoke only when spoken to, and never once raised his hand or volunteered an answer. He was as invisible as a man could be in a cramped classroom of 12 students. But then that was his special talent, making himself invisible to those around him. On the streets of nearby Portsmouth, where they performed the bulk of their field exercises, Keller's formidable skills were harder to conceal. He cleaned out his dead drop sites without raising so much as an eyebrow. His brush contacts were textbook. 6 weeks into the course, MI5 sent down a team of A4 watchers to assist in a day-long counter-surveillance drill. The point of the exercise was to demonstrate that proper physical surveillance, the real thing, not the Banana Republic variety, was almost impossible to detect. The other recruits failed to spot a single one of their MI5 watchers, but Keller was able to correctly identify 4 members of a crack team who tailed him during an excursion to the Cascades shopping center. Incredulous, MI5 demanded a second chance, but the results were the same. The next day's session was dedicated not to identifying surveillance, but shaking it. Keller dumped his team in 5 minutes flat and vanished without a trace. They found him later that night, singing French-accented karaoke at the Druid's Arms in Binstead Road. He left the pub with the name, phone number, and address of everyone in the room, along with a proposal of marriage. Next morning, Quill called personnel at Vauxhall Cross and asked where they had found the man called Peter Marlowe. "We didn't find him," said personnel. "He's seized private stock." "Send me 10 more just like him," said Quill, "and Britain will rule the world again." The real work of the IONEC was done in the evenings, in the recruits' private bar and dining hall. They were encouraged to drink. Alcohol, they were told, played an important part in the life of a spy, and several times each week a special guest joined them for dinner. Controllers, policy experts, legendary operatives. A few still worked for the service, others were cobwebbed figures in crumpled suits who recalled their duels with the KGB in Berlin and Vienna and Moscow. Russia was once again MI6's primary target, an adversary. The great game, said a dried-out Cold Warrior, had been renewed. Quill warned his students that in time, the Russians would make a play for each and every one of them, with flattery, with offers of money, or with blackmail. How they responded when the bear came calling would determine whether they slept at night or rotted in a self-made hell. He then played a video of Kim Philby's famous 1955 press conference, where he denied he was a KGB spy. Quill called it the finest piece of lying he had ever seen or ever would. James Bond might have had a license to kill, but real-world MI6 officers did not. Assassination as a tool was strictly forbidden, and most British spies rarely carried a gun, let alone fired one in the line of duty. Still, they were not merely champagne spies, not all of them at least, and the world was an increasingly dangerous place, which meant they had to possess a basic understanding of how to operate a weapon, where one inserted the magazine, how one chambered the round, how one held the contraption so as not to shoot oneself or a fellow agent, that sort of thing. Here again, Keller's proficiency was difficult to camouflage. On the first day of weapons training, the instructor handed him a pistol, a Browning 9mm, and told him to fire it toward the human silhouette target 15 meters down the range. Keller raised the weapon swiftly, and without seeming to take aim, poured all 13 rounds through the target's head. When asked to repeat the exercise, he placed an entire magazine's worth of rounds through the target's left eye. Henceforth, he was excused from further firearms training. Nor was he required to take part in the IONEC's rudimentary self-defense course, not after nearly dislocating the shoulder of an instructor who had foolishly pointed an unloaded gun in his direction. After that, no one, not even Mayhew, who was built like a rugby player, would set foot on the mat with him. They were kept largely isolated from the civilian population around them, but Mayhew and Quill made no effort to sequester them from the outside world, far from it, in fact. A stack of British and international newspapers waited at breakfast each morning, and in the lounge was a television that received all of the global and European news networks. They huddled around it the night of the attack on London, in despair and anger, and in the knowledge that this was the war in which they would all soon be fighting, one sooner than the rest. The following week, the IONEC reached its conclusion. All 12 members of the intake passed easily, with Peter Marlowe receiving the highest score, and Finch a respectable but distant second. That evening they dined together one last time in the company of Mayhew and Quill, and in the morning they placed their room keys on old George Halliday's desk and carried their bags outside into the courtyard where Reg, the driver, waited behind the wheel of a coach to take them, newly minted spies, up to London.